Welcome to Careers in Discovery, where you'll meet scientists who've forged outstanding careers in biotech and hear about what they've learned along the way. This podcast is brought to you by Singular, building brilliant biotechs. Jonathan Steckbeck is the CEO of Peptilogix, a biotech company combining peptide biology and machine learning to recreate the future of peptide biologics. Jonathan talks us through his career so far, how business and science are fundamentally related, why every decision is made on a continuum, and the challenge of letting go of control as a CEO. This week on Careers in Discovery, I'm delighted to be joined by Jonathan Steckbeck of Peptilogix. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great to see you. So I'm fascinated by the concept you're working on there at Peptilogix. And I'd really like to start by talking a little bit more about recreating the future of peptide therapeutics.
Sure. Thanks. Yeah. So but a little bit of context, right? Because that's a pretty big statement. And so really this started back with my graduate studies. Mm-hmm. And those were around kind of understanding how peptides interacted with lipid membranes, right? So kind of the things that surround cells. And what we were doing, or part of what we were doing, was using that understanding to try to make better drugs, particularly in a class that had had a bunch of challenges since its discovery in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. So our lead drug program is, I'll call it by name, it's called PLG0206. From here on out, I'm just going to call it 206 because it's less of a mouthful.
Yeah,
makes sense. A little bit easier to say. So that drug is, it's broadly based on this class of compounds called antimicrobial peptides. And mm-hmm. So what it does is it interacts with the bacterial cell membrane and causes it to essentially leak, which kills the bacteria. And so what we were doing, or what we had done, was, again, it was a class that had been around for a long time. We had a starting point that we were using, which was a naturally occurring peptide. And then we started to modify it to try to see how we could, you know, change its activity or how we could modulate activity.
Yes.
And so we had a pretty good understanding of that. And then as we were following other compounds that had been moving further into the clinic, we had seen, so like I said, they had some challenges. A lot of those challenges were associated with safety and tox. Mm-hmm. And that was often due to inflammation. And so what we were doing, or what the hypothesis we developed from that, was the idea that, you know, inflammation is usually kind of a receptor-driven process. Mm-hmm. So there's specificity involved. And so with peptides, the nice thing about them is they're kind of block polymers, right? You can think about them almost as Lego blocks. You can snap together whatever you want, kind of in any order that you want. And what our idea there was we had a good understanding of how we can modulate the activity of the molecule. If specificity drives the tox problem, well, could we design a molecule to kind of improve its activity, but remove the tox problems, right? Mm-hmm. Remove any kind of sequence specificity that might exist. And so that's what we did. That's how we arrived at 206.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And so then I started the company around that idea to move that program forward. But also, as that program moved forward, it would give us, if it worked, it would give us some validation that mm-hmm. this idea of designing molecules, these peptides, could actually, designing them to do what you want them to do, could actually work.
Yes.
And so now what we're doing is taking that idea, which is broadly, you know, so if you think about what we did for 206, we essentially engineered in or designed inactivity out tox. So we encoded biological properties. So now what we're doing is using modern computational techniques, kind of broadly talk about them, machine learning, artificial intelligence, to scale that approach beyond just kind of those two properties, but also into the larger peptide space.
Yes, I see. And so you spun out the company, or you started up the company, I should say, coming up to 10 years ago now. from what I can see. And I suppose those computational elements, machine learning existed at the time, of course, and computational biology existed at the time. But in that period of time, they've advanced rapidly, right? So that must have had a huge impact on how you view the business as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that was a, you know, it was kind of a convergence of a few things, right? So first, the data from 206 continued to be good and continued to be good. So we just finished up enrollment in a human POC trial. So that drug is progressing well. But then, as you say, you know, there were kind of two pieces on the computational side. So one around the different algorithms and the types of ways that you would approach it. So maybe broadly kind of the machine learning and AI aspect of it. But then also alongside that is the computational power to be able to actually do it.
Yes.
So we think about it as a convergence of those three things. So, you know, kind of the peptide science, the algorithms, and then the compute.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the company today is, as you say, you're in clinical studies with your lead program, and you're then applying the principles of that you've used on that program to other programs as well.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Trying to decode biology.
It's a big
statement, but I think that's, you know, I think that really comes down to where I think we are with machine learning. I think we're getting to the point where that's actually more possible. Look, and I don't want to get into a philosophical, you know, a philosophical discussion off here, but, you know, whether or not that will ever be completely possible, biology is incredibly complex. But yes. I think these techniques and these tools are the best, you know, the best way we have to approach that.
No, of course, of course. And so we'll talk a bit about your journey with the company, and I'm sure there's lots of twists and turns and lessons in that. But, you know, today with the company as it is now, as the CEO, where do you spend most of your time? What's your attention on most of the time these days?
My attention is, I try to say, like, I don't have a favorite child. So so I have three main things that I'm trying to do is, you know, well, and maybe they all roll up into one kind of broad thing is like, I'm kind of the evangelist for the company, right? Mm-hmm. And so what that broadly translates into is, you know, talking about what it is that we're doing that's unique in both the kind of platform aspects or the computational aspects of what we're doing, because I think we're taking a unique approach there. And then likewise on the drug side, you know, explaining to people why exactly, you know, our approach to this disease that we're tackling is the best way to go about it.
Yep.
And then that all kind of rolls up into making sure that we have the ability to continue to do those things into the future.
Yes, I see. So as the person who's, I suppose, I imagine, been with the program for longer than anybody else, right? You're well positioned to do that.
Yes.
So then going, we'll come back to Peptilogix, and I do want to talk more about the company. Going a long way back, we talked about, before we started recording, a little bit the path you'd taken prior to that point. Because you, as you've touched on, you trained as a scientist and went down a scientific route initially with a couple of other interests, shall we say. But why science in the first place? Why this area of career for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up, it was just, I don't know, you know, kind of the best way to satisfy almost a natural curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the, you know, as a kid, just trying to figure out how everything worked, right? And, you know, probably being that annoying, questioning everything, right? The continual whys. So yeah, it was really a function of being able to, it was the place, kind of the discipline that was open-ended enough to be able to kind of think about finding new things. And, you know, it really encouraged that, because I contrast it a little bit, because, you know, engineering is also a place that you could go, but that's a little more, and it's something we think about a lot now, because it's, we're trying to bring some of the disparate disciplines together, but engineering tends to be a little more prescriptive. And, you know, I think, again, kind of being biologically focused, don't think we're at the point yet where we're fully prescriptive on that. And it's really a matter of understanding, describing, and then implementing what we learn.
No, absolutely. I suppose biology has much more capacity to surprise you, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I tell the team, like, you know, drug discovery to me is like the biggest miracle that we can ever accomplish, because, you know, if you think about what you're doing, again, kind of from, doesn't matter what it is, what the modality is, but you're finding something ostensibly that didn't really exist for the most part, right? 99% of the time, you're taking something that never existed, and then you're putting it into the most complex system that we know of. Right? So this, the human body is the most complex thing that we understand, that we understand, I guess, that we know exists, because we don't fully, but it's this thing that we don't fully understand. Right. And so we don't know what happens when you put those things into the body. And so what you're trying to do is take this thing that never existed, put it into this thing that we don't understand. Hope it does one really specific thing. Hope it does one specific thing and not a bunch of other bad things in order to kind of give us better health. And so the fact that that ever works is, again, kind of a miracle.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice way to think about it, because, you know, you speak to a lot of people in the industry and they talk a lot about failure rate. And it's, of course, it's accepted and it's part of the game and it's what happens. But I think, as you say, you can look at it the other way, that it's amazing that this thing ever works, let alone there's a high failure rate.
Well, yeah. And as we, and, you know, I think that the really nice thing is now, as we, you know, as we understand more, and I think we're getting a better kind of systems level view of biology, not a fully descriptive, you know, by any means, but a better understanding, you know, I think we'll continue to see the rates get better, right?
Yes.
The failures will exist, because, again, we don't, you know, it's one of the few places you could do, you know, if you fail and do a post-mortem, you might have done everything as right as you could have possibly done it. And biology still just gives you a surprise, gives you a surprise. So I think we'll continue to see those, but I think it'll be, you know, less and less.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, picking up on what you said earlier, the computational elements that you're able to build in now have a huge influence on that, right? Because the amount you can simulate. Yeah, absolutely. And so you followed that passion through to studying biochemistry. At what point did you decide that it was drug discovery that was the path you were going to take it down?
Yeah, so maybe just kind of historically, maybe kind of start from not quite the beginning, so we've covered that. But so I went to do my undergraduate in microbiology. And a few summers between semesters, I interned at a biotech company.
Right.
And that was really kind of the point of understanding that, you know, there's a product approach to this.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I learned there was that while the scientists may do all the really cool work, they don't always get to make the decisions on what work gets done, or at least, you know, kind of from a program level.
Yeah.
And so that was really the point of, you know, starting to think about how to bring together business and science. And so I finished that and I went to work for a few years doing research on HIV, trying to understand the immune response. And if we could kind of understand how the immune system responded, maybe we could design vaccines to direct it more effectively.
Yes.
After a few years, then I went and got an MBA. So really that kind of the first step of, I like to think about it broadly as learning the language of business. So try to understand, you know, margins in business are not the same thing as margins in cell biology, right?
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Right? So being able to understand and speak those two different languages, and then worked for a couple more years, and then decided to get a PhD because I think partially to satisfy a natural curiosity, but also really, so in now that intervening time, I had moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the US. And so Pittsburgh has a really great research ecosystem. So it has a number of, you know, kind of well-renowned universities. So University of Pittsburgh, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, UPMC now, Carnegie Mellon. And so there's a lot of great research that gets done there, but at the time, not a lot of that research really translated out. And so so my goal going into the PhD was a little bit different probably than most people's, because it was to, you know, basically try to find a technology that I could work on, really understand it as well as possible, and then hopefully turn that into a commercial, commercial enterprise. And so that's how we ended up here.
So that must have given you a slightly different view on your PhD than a lot of people go in with, right? Because and also the training that you'd had through your MBA. Because I think you're right. I think you know, as people learn more about business, I think they tend to find that a lot of it is applied common sense, right? But there, you can make it more complicated than that, of course. And there are tools that you learn that are effective in getting the most out of your business. But going in with that intention and with that foundation, I imagine informed how you approached your PhD to some extent. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I think there was very much a, and maybe I can contrast it to, and it's always hard because you don't know everybody's exact circumstances,
sure.
But, you know, there was a very clear kind of purpose to what I was trying to do, mm-hmm. right? And so that allowed for a, you know, maybe a different type of focus around not just, you know, what lab to pick to go into, but then also what projects, right? So how do you start to build, if you know what the end goal might look like, then you can start to build the foundation of, okay, what do I actually need to understand about this thing? Because, you know, even in biotech, in the business, it still is built around the science. And so mm-hmm. you have to have a good understanding of, you know, the mechanism, and you have to be able to speak to that.
Yes.
And so being able to, like I said, see what the end could be and then build the foundation from that was probably a little differently than most end up approaching it. But and then having, again, I think, you know, the interesting thing about the idea of, you know, kind of the MBA and the approach that might have and how different business and science might be, I actually saw it as being more, a lot more in common than you might think, because mm-hmm. they're both very analytical mm-hmm. at their core, right? Is kind of, in a lot of ways, you take data and you try to understand how to manipulate that data, or how you can play with it to understand, you know, either the underlying structure of the business or the underlying yes. structure of a cell.
Yeah. Yeah. And we talk about that quite a bit on this podcast, actually, the business skills that you develop as a researcher that you don't realize you're developing a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually one of the, because I think as we were chatting just briefly, I do try to spend some time talking to grad students and postdocs. Mm. And that's the one thing that, you know, maybe was an unintended learning from kind of going through the PhD is how good of a training it actually is for kind of entrepreneurship.
Yes.
Because if you think about what you're doing is you're trying to solve a, you know, an unknown problem in both cases, right? Mm-hmm. Ideally, if you know, you're in graduate school or you're kind of working in science generally, what you're trying to figure out is, you know, stuff at the edges, right? And so you're trying to,
yeah.
you know, it's not so cool or not so exciting if it's not new.
No, true. Yeah.
And so you're trying to collect and synthesize a lot of different types of information to make hypotheses about something and then test them. And that's, you know, roughly at the same level of kind of what a startup is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, the interesting thing that I find is that the parallels between science and business, particularly entrepreneurship, are founded in something that I think people outside of those two worlds don't really think they have in common, in that they're both really creative at their core. Mm-hmm. And like you say, you're creating something from nothing. You're building on what's gone before, of course, but taking it somewhere it hasn't been taken before. And I think, the skills that you develop, but also I think the mentality that you develop around that has to be kind of the same, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the you know, another big thing there is the, you know, the comfort or ability to kind of live in uncertainty, mm-hmm. right? Is, you know, when you don't have, which you almost never do, kind of a very clear path, or, you know, the information that you've gathered don't point, you know, in one, you know, kind of vector, but it's more of a distribution of potential outcomes, right? Being able to be comfortable with that and understand, okay, if those are the collection of outcomes that could be, what data do I need to collect? What do I need to do? What decisions do I need to make to move yes. forward? And then how do I move from there? Right. So it's being able to do that and being comfortable with that, as comfortable as anybody ever is. Mm. Right. But I think that there are a lot of parallels, or a lot of things that you learn or that get reinforced during a PhD program that apply and are very similar to what you experience when starting a company.
No, absolutely. And so you'd done your best to set yourself up for success with this in choosing the lab, choosing the project that you thought, I assume, had the most chance of being having commercial potential, I suppose. But of course, I would guess that at the time, there's still a lot of work to do to make sure that it does, and it's not quite there yet, right? So was there a point at which you got in your research where you thought, okay, yeah, this is the one, this has got legs? You know, how did you tell that that was the thing to pursue?
Yeah, so for this one, it was, you know, again, in the context of drugs and the fact that it could, biology could fall apart at any point in time, true, right? You could run into something that you don't understand. But again, understanding that's a given and that's just how it is. Mm-hmm. It was really when, you know, the early animal studies looked good. And by good, I mean, you know, you were able to, so what we work on is it's kind of like an antibiotic, right? So mm-hmm. it kills bacteria.
Yeah.
And so you were able to, you know, give it to the animals, they survived. And that was good for two reasons. One, because you were able to treat the disease. But then again, because of the class, you also didn't have the tox problems that were associated with
right,
it.
Yes.
And so and that was the kind of first real point where, you know, you were in a complex system, right? Because if you think about what we're doing in the context of discovery, it is simple systems, try to understand the mechanism. And as you move kind of to the right, you go into increasingly complex systems. And so animals are the closest things we have to humans in complexity. And so when it looked promising in the animals, then it was, I felt pretty good about it.
Yeah, of course. And so you'd gone in with the intention of starting a business on the back mm-hmm. of this. So I guess there wasn't that point of decision making necessary. You kind of already made that decision that if it showed promise, you were gonna go ahead and pursue it. So there's that. But then I suppose taking that step and going and day one, setting up the business and you know, sitting in a room potentially on your own, perhaps with a couple of other people, is a different proposition, right? So tell us about those memories you have from the very early days of the business and how things progressed from that.
Yeah, so we were fortunate because I think, you know, one of the things that had changed in maybe kind of since the early 2000s when I did my MBA and when I started, you know, I was looking to start the company in the early 2010s was the idea of entrepreneurship as a career, particularly in science. And mm-hmm. so, and as we talk about, it's by no means pushed or, excuse me, something that is incredibly common now, though it's becoming more. Mm. But there were, you know, mechanisms in place to kind of try to ease or try to help ease that transition. And so locally here in Pittsburgh, there was a group called Idea Foundry, which was an incubator, right?
Right.
And so we had applied, got into the, you know, got accepted into their class or I don't know exactly what they call it, and started to work with folks who had some experience in kind of that translational aspect to start to put a plan around what it was that this could be. Because I think one of the early challenges that we had was kind of it harkened back to the discovery of the class of molecules itself, right? So these were
right.
molecules that were discovered in the 80s and were hailed as they were going to be the next kind of penicillin,
mm-hmm.
right? Is, you know, brand new thing that we had never seen and had a completely different mechanism of action. And so if you have something like that, knowing kind of what happened with antibiotics after, like, where do you start?
Right.
And so there were so, and I think it's that way for drug development in general, is when you have kind of a, when you find something so basic, trying to figure out what the first application is can be part of the most difficult. So having that guidance was helpful.
Yes, I see. Yeah. And I think that's an important distinction, isn't it? As people, because I think there's been a shift in trend from companies that are driven by a therapeutic program to companies that look at a platform, right? And you then have a lead program usually within that. But I think mm-hmm. the push, whether it's from investors or from others, is to look at what are the other applications. But then, of course, there's a discipline that's inherently required in that you're looking at all the applications, but you've usually got to pick one, right? You know, there's normally not enough resource to pursue even two of them, I guess. So was there anything that helped you with that decision making?
Yeah, to some extent there was, and it was more of an external factor, actually. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so for 206, we were initially developing it. Where we had centered on was kind of broadly, there's a, you know, I think everybody's heard of kind of antimicrobial resistance or mm-hmm. you know, bacterial drug resistance, and you know, the looming threat that it poses. And so we, again, having a new mechanism of action and being able to kill those kinds of bugs, our original intent was to develop it as a kind of I'll call it a typical antibiotic, right? So delivered parenterally, you know, into kind of systemically to be able to treat those types of infections. And the reason to do that was because the regulatory path was well understood.
Yes.
You know, if it worked, you did, you know, a urinary tract infection trial or an intradominal infection trial. And the kind of regulatory path was well understood. Mm. Now, over, and so that was in the mid-2010s, so around 2017, maybe later, 2017, 2018. The challenge there is not so much scientific and regulatory, but it ended up being commercial, where you had a number of companies who were trying it, so bringing new drugs to market. Mm-hmm. And once they got approved, the companies went bankrupt because they just, you know, without going into the details of it, the commercial kind of support system for novel antibiotics just isn't there right now.
Yes.
We don't have a good way to get them paid for.
Yes.
And so what we were doing then is, as we were looking to develop it for that, so we were kind of in the later stages of preclinical work, right? So kind of doing the animal studies to get ready to file an IND, an investigational new drug application in the US, to then be able to administer it to humans for testing. We were also working using with a collaborator, using the drug to treat a different type of infection. And so these infections were associated with hardware in the body. So in this particular case, prosthetic joints, right? So if your knee wears out or your hip wears out, you get a new plastic and metal joint. And most of the time it works great. However, if you get an infection, what ends up happening is we don't have good therapeutic options. So our typical antibiotics don't work. And so what we have to do, and this was surprising to me, is that we still treat them in orthopedic infections in general, actually, the same way we treated things in the Middle Ages or the Civil War. We have to cut it out.
Right.
Because the drugs don't work. And so the surgeon that we were working with, Ken Urish, was testing it. So he's an orthopedic surgeon. And so he was testing this in his models of this infection and was finding that it worked incredibly well. Mm. And so we looked at the business case for that, saw that there was a really nice opportunity there. And because, you know, there is no therapeutic option, we believe there's actually commercial potential in that, a pretty nice commercial potential in that indication. And so at that time, we made the switch from, okay, take this well-understood regulatory pathway with no commercial, you know, limited, no commercial opportunity to, all right, we're gonna have to figure out some new stuff here. But if we do, and I think there's precedent for being able to do that, then there's a really nice commercial opportunity on the other side.
No, absolutely. And you're right, that is surprising that that's still treated. Do you think, I mean, it sounds like your business training probably had an influence on that decision. I appreciate you don't necessarily know how these decisions are made in other companies as well. I think, you know, we often see that the sort of the entire focus, as much as you might think about commercial application, the entire focus while doing drug discovery is on getting to preclinical studies, right? And then it's getting through those preclinical studies into the clinic, and then it's getting, and often it's kind of, you get so far down the line before the commercial issues come to light that it becomes very expensive and very difficult to pivot at that point, where it's much easier early on. Do you think that the way you'd approached sort of your training had influenced looking at those things earlier than perhaps was the norm?
I'm not sure if it was the training in particular or just my personal kind of way I approach things. So, you know, made college difficult actually, because I tend to approach problems holistically.
Okay.
And so I try to understand the whole thing so that I can understand everything. And so practically in college, when you kind of build the base and then go to the, go to the end, I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't like that way. So, so maybe, but I think it is surprising that approach isn't taken more often, because you're right. Like, so much effort. And then look, and part of it is because it is a science-driven industry, and understanding kind of everything you want to understand about the drug is hard, and it takes a lot of work. And, you know, there is somewhat of a separation between, kind of, again, science at the preclinical and even clinical stage, and then commercialization. Those are just different skill sets.
Absolutely.
So, you know, there may be a little bit of that, because companies generally, especially smaller companies, aren't generally built kind of with that view across the spectrum, right? You solve for the problem at hand. But I think it is, that's something we've tried to encode into all our, the way we do things, right? Is, okay, if this works, right? Because that's going to be hard, right? And it's going to take a lot of work to figure it out. But if it works, what happens on the other side?
Yeah,
because absolutely. That actually, look, if you want to create a sustainable company, you have to be able to understand that, and you have to have an answer to that question.
Yeah. And I suppose there's a balance to strike there, though, right? In that you want to retain some strategic flexibility as well. But as you say, you want to at least think through the potential repercussions of this.
Yeah. Understanding that everything, kind of every decision, is a continuum or a distribution, right?
Yeah.
And actually, kind of coming back to one of the things that we talked about earlier, I think being able to understand that, right, and understand that there is an inherent, you know, distribution of outcomes at every point in time is, and so you have kind of built-in optionality. You just have to be able to kind of recognize it, characterize it, and then deal with it.
Yes. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And then, so tell us a bit about where things went from there. So I suppose there's lots of things that have happened over the last 10 years. But you know, the things that I suppose were key lessons for you, either as the leader of a business, or, you know, in terms of the scientific end of the work you were doing. Tell us a bit about the sort of formative parts of the last few years.
Sure. Yeah, I think maybe the one thing that it was surprising, but perhaps shouldn't be, was how rigorous the science actually has to be, right? So, because as you come up through academics, I think there's this characterization of, and maybe it's just academics, it's the kind of public in general, there's a characterization of pharmaceutical companies as they're just kind of like freeloading off of everybody else's work.
Right.
And it really, you know, a drug is created when it's first kind of discovered or invented, and that's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because the amount of work that has to go in from the discovery through kind of getting it approved to be able to administer to humans as a medicine is incredible, and it requires an incredible amount of rigor. And so I think that was, again, kind of the one, maybe a large scale characterization of what happens, or maybe how pharmaceutical companies operate, and the rigor with which they operate, and kind of the science that's done within them is often mischaracterized. It's as rigorous, or probably more than just about anywhere else, because it has to be.
Yes.
Right. Because if you think about what you're doing, is you're spending an incredible amount of money to try to prove that this molecule that somebody discovered can perform that miracle, right? Can turn into that medicine. And if it doesn't, then I don't want to say wasted all that money, because, you know, you learn something from all of it.
Yes.
But, you know, you've spent money that didn't end up working out. And So trying to balance that actually requires an incredible amount of discipline and rigor.
Absolutely. No, and I think that's right. And I think then the sort of regulatory burden is there as well for good reasons, right? And you have to then create the ability to repeatedly generate that data, and that proves its own challenges, right? Especially as you scale up.
Yeah. I would say it's not an anecdote, but the reproducibility challenge that has kind of become more of a conversation in science over the last, say, 10 years, I think exists less in let's call it biopharma than it does elsewhere.
Yeah, fair enough. And for you, Jonathan, this is a question I always ask people, and feel free to take a little bit of time to think about it. One of my observations is that everybody approaches the role of CEO differently. And I think you have to, right? Because you have to do it with authenticity, and you have to do it based on your own beliefs and your own principles. And you have to have conviction in those while also, taking on board the expertise of other people, of course. And I think as well, if you're doing that job well, you should be finding yourself in lots of situations that you've never encountered before. And so there's constant development and constant learning, and nobody's ever sort of arrived, I am now a CEO and I've learned everything about it, and no other lessons need to be learned. So I appreciate it's an ongoing process. Has there been anything for you that sort of has been the most challenging part of that development into that role?
Yeah, I think that one is mostly around, and I don't know if this is kind of a broad founder problem or what it is, but the team is absolutely critical. And I think what I didn't talk about just in the last question was things that I learned is that having a good team gives you incredible leverage and lets you do so much more than you could possibly do on your own. The challenge is, as particularly somebody being so close to the kind of science and then the buildup of it, right? So, I started the company, it was, we went in a very capital efficient manner, which just means it was, me and a few consultants, right? Mm-hmm. So trying to bring all that stuff together. And so as we've grown, passing some of those things off and being okay with, I'm not running that I'm not running that anymore. And every time I call somebody to give them my thoughts, they're like, please leave me alone. Like, I have this, right? I got this. You hired me to do this job. Let me do it. So I think trying to find that balance is something that, have to constantly work on.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is difficult, right? Because you have to remain vigilant, of course. But as you say, there's this emotional element to letting go of control of things that used to be in your domain, right? Which always makes you, I suppose, somewhat suspicious is too strong a word, but somewhat questioning of your judgment around whether you're being vigilant or whether you're interfering, right?
Yeah, and so the biggest thing there is just getting to, trying to find and hire the right people, and for us, the right people is, or the ones we've found to be the most kind of successful within the company are those, and what we try to build, right? And so maybe that's just to make sure I characterize it appropriately, is, people who are aligned with what we're trying to do. And so, and maybe it's not so I think about the way I approached it is, there's a couple of ways you could build a company, right? You could build kind of like a team of stars, and you could do that. Or you could build a company that's around where everybody is really kind of there for the mission. And there's been some academic work done on this, for better or worse, but it was done. Mm-hmm. And what they found over the long term is that companies built where kind of everybody is there for the mission and kind of for each other actually end up being more successful in the long run. Yeah. And so finding the folks who have the requisite skill set, right? Because that's kind of the table stakes is being able to do the job and understand what it is. But then the motivations behind why you're doing it, actually we find to be incredibly important, because for us, you know, what I hinted at the beginning was every look, drug discovery is hard, right? We just talked about how it's kind of a miracle that it ever works. And so then we layer on top of that a drug indication where the regulatory path isn't well understood, but the on the other side of it, we think the commercial opportunity is good. But so we have to build a lot of even how we think about development program.
Yeah.
And then on the other side with the computational aspect, all of that is new, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
it's a brand new way to think about how do we collect the right data? How do we analyze that data? Then how do we turn what we analyzed into useful insights to making new drugs, right? So it's all really hard. And so if you're not kind of working, if you're not okay with that and then working to try to figure that out with a group of people who are trying to figure it out with you, it's going to be hard. It's going to be harder than it needs to be.
Yeah.
Right? And when you do that, it's just fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So is this what you found has worked for you, is finding people who really buy into the mission and what you're trying to achieve, and that's helped you to build
that? That's a much more succinct way to say it than I did, yes.
The context is useful. The context is useful. But, you know, I think it's right. I think, you know, a lot of people come into biotech entrepreneurship not necessarily with a huge amount of experience of leading teams or hiring people or any of that sort of stuff. And I think, you know, the conversations we always have with people in that part of our business is, listen, people are the most expensive usually, and the most expensive part of your business and the part of your business that probably creates the most headaches and hassle, but they're also the most brilliant part of your business, the bit that makes it fun and the part that makes it work, and you can't do it without them. So, you know, there's upsides and downsides to everything, but you get the people right and, you know, the rest of it tends to follow, right?
Yeah.
But it's hard.
And that's,
it's hard
to do. It is. And that was, you know, again, maybe something that I didn't appreciate as much because, again, like going through kind of academic training doesn't give you that. And and so I didn't come from a kind of a large company where you get that understanding, right? Where you're leading teams and you have to, you know, they take very, there are programs to develop managers in larger companies. And so, you know, what I've found useful is, again, kind of being very self-reflective, understanding what I'm good at, what I know, what I don't know, and then supplementing that with folks who kind of bring that same mindset but have different skills, right? And
right.
then just saying, okay, that's now your bucket, or you know, I'm going to always need your input on those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose this kind of goes back to the letting go of control thing you were talking about, in that, you know, I had a look at the team before we had this conversation that you've put together there, and it's a very experienced team, and you've had to bring in people, you have brought in people who are way more experienced in their area than you are, and that's the right thing to do. So I suppose building a level of comfort with that is also important, right?
Yeah, and that's its own, and again, so thanks for the I think the team's great. And all those things are true. And just, I think the thing you have to be careful to not lose though sometimes too is, yes, they are experts in their fields, but you know, that doesn't minimize kind of what you know about it too, right? So that there's a constant, and I think that's, you know, just given kind of the tenor of the show, I think that's important to kind of let people and make people aware of, is that yes, you're going to bring in, if you do it right, you're going to bring people in who have more experience than you in certain things. But that doesn't mean that your opinion or the way you think about it isn't valid as well.
No, of course. Of course. And it's those diversities of backgrounds that really get you to the best solutions, right?
But I will say that's, I think, the one thing PhD programs do try to do is they part of it is like trying to get you to the point where you know what you don't know. And sometimes maybe the unintended consequence of that is you're not always sure of your opinions, right? So just what I'm trying to reinforce for the audience is that, you know, you can bring in people who are very experienced and still have very, like, your opinions are good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I had, I had lunch once with a guy who, in a very different sector, he was a really successful CEO of an insurance company actually, and had become a billionaire through it and all this kind of stuff. And one of the things that he said that stuck with me was, listen, you don't have to know everything as the CEO of a company. just enough to be dangerous. And I think what you were saying was just enough to sort of, you know, to remind people that you would know whether what they were saying was right or valid, or that you could bring your opinion to it, or, you know, you had to know enough about everything to keep everyone pulling in the same direction, and to be able to hold those threads together. And that's really what it ends up being, right?
Yeah, you're providing the guidance, and you're exactly right. You have to know enough to be able to make sure, again, that you're guiding everybody in the same direction.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So coming back today and coming back to Peptilogix, program in the clinic, other things developing. Tell us a little bit about what's next for the business and what the near future holds.
Yeah. So that's our lead program. The way that's structured is, you know, we're developing it again for these infections associated with, like we talked about earlier, the prosthetic joints, but we really look at that as kind of the entry point into being able to treat this broader set of diseases that we don't have a good treatment for, which is basically anywhere you put in kind of hardware in the body, right? So something like a foreign body, we still pretty much treat those the same way, which is, you know, we try to throw drugs at it, it doesn't work, and then we end up cutting it out. And so, you know, we're going to continue to push 206 forward for this joint infection, which is called broadly PJI, periprosthetic joint infection. But then start to move and do the studies necessary to expand that. So we really look at that as a kind of a pipeline and a product, or a franchising approach, which is establish. And so our kind of general strategy here is establish that the molecule, the drug, is effective in the hardest thing to treat. Once you do that, then it makes everything downstream a little bit easier.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think it's a really interesting approach. And, you know, you've been able to take something that has always had huge potential, but address that critical problem with it. And so we wish you the best of luck with it, Jonathan.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
Thanks very much for listening. Careers in Discovery is sponsored by Singular, helping you to build a brilliant biotech company. Biotech leaders spend far too much time, money, and energy on hiring and people issues. Head to www.singular-biotech.com to learn how you can recruit and engage your team more effectively so you can focus on developing medicines, treating patients, and saving lives.